show is
boring. This is What is Love? Fantasy
is a safe space to communicate about your fantasies and passions without fear of judgment. It is a dating app for open-minded couples and singles to experiment with your desires that don't have to be secret anymore.
Okay.
If you're down and confused and you don't remember who you're talking to, concentration slip away, because your baby is so far away.
Okay, this is What is Love, and mostly you'll be listening to Sasha Sugar previously, but I'm now guest hosting. In a previous episode of What is Love, you might remember that Sasha was describing her journey, from her personal journey from drug use to awakening, and the point that we left the show off at was that she was at a point where she was open to different things and different languages, using language to describe her experiences. And for many of you, using that language or understanding how to discern our experiences using language is being the focus of this show, that we're going to talk about it within the terms of Buddhism, that Buddhism offers a view of love that is very precise. And I'm here with Michelle Valadares. If you could introduce yourself, Michelle. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me to Radio Free Brooklyn. My name is Michelle Valadares. I'm a poet, and I teach at the City College of New York, and I direct the MFA program in creative writing. And I've been studying Buddhism for 20 years with the Kadampa Buddhists.
Great, great. And I think that many people are looking for the light of knowledge, light of wisdom, light of love in their life. And that comes from the flames of experience. And what I think Buddhism offers is the technology to be able to use, technology being like the meditations, the disciplines of Buddhism, and use that vocabulary to discriminate our experiences. So I'll start off with this question: is what is love in Buddhist terms?
Okay, it's a huge question. So in Buddhism and all my definitions, I'll be referring to my teacher's books. So my teacher is Geshe Kelsang Gyatso, and the book that I'm referring to is Modern Buddhism, which is available for free to download. So all of Buddha's teachings, first I want to say, I'm not sure who the listeners are, but one of the things that Geshe Kelsang says about Buddhist methods of looking at love is that these are scientific methods for improving our human nature and qualities through developing the capacity of our minds. So regardless of what your background is, regardless of where you're coming from, you don't have to be a Buddhist. These methods of training the mind of a meditation are going to help you. So love for Buddhism, for Buddhists, is a mind. I think conventionally we think of love as these feelings. And when we experience these feelings, we like it. Oftentimes they're mixed with minds of attachment. Mm-hmm. So for Buddhism, pure love is a mind that wishes others to be happy.
Yeah, I think that once, my understanding of what you're saying is that once you're in that place of being where you experience love, or you are love, that then everything, all the experiences that you're having come from that place of love. Would you say?
Absolutely. And the premise is so love is a positive mind. It's a virtuous mind. And so what we try to do as Buddhists is we try to train in virtuous minds, you know, kind of building up a storage, like you go to the bank to put your money in to save, right? So in Buddhism, we have a kind of mind bank, and we want to store as many positive minds. And love, compassion, universal love, all of these are on the spectrum of this wonderful mind. The greatest mind of love in Buddhism we call bodhicitta. Mm. And bodhi is made up of two Sanskrit words, bodhi meaning mind of enlightenment, bodhi meaning enlightenment, citta meaning mind.
Mm.
So mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta. That's the greatest expression of love, and that's the mind that just wishes everyone to be happy. So we train by training we just start with, you know, affectionate love, and then we have cherishing love. So these are all meditations on the step to developing. And yes, to developing love. And yes, I would agree with you that once we sort of mix our mind with these meditations on love, our capacity for love increases.
Yeah.
And everything we do is infused with love. So if you're cooking a meal, or if you're writing, or if you're talking to a friend on the phone, if you're, someone is hurt or sick and you're with them, all your actions are infused with love.
And I think that a lot of times people have that view that, oh, I only experience love under external circumstances. They look at the external circumstances and they say, oh, I only experience that love when I'm with someone or when I'm in a certain situation.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to shift that perspective to knowing that it's really a mind state, a state of mind that that informs that. If you can explain a little bit more about the difference between those external circumstances being a requirement and kind of the state of being.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great point. So right now, we think, if we're, you know, sort of normal beings walking around, we think that the things outside our mind make us happy. But if we check, or the things, you know, or that we have to encounter an object of love, to feel love.
Mm.
But if we check, like using happiness, for example, like maybe the sun makes us happy and maybe summer makes us happy. But if we check, every single sunny day in the summer does not make us happy, right? There are things that arise, conflict, problems, and we're unhappy. So this is just a very simple check to make us have this awareness that it's happiness isn't arising from things outside the mind, that happiness and suffering are states of mind. In the same way, love is a state of mind, right? So, we can just check with the people that we love. Sometimes we love them, and sometimes they make us really angry. And sometimes the people we dislike the most are the people that just previously, last week, we loved the most, you know, and we can check our relationships, and we can think about our friends. And so it's not that person inherently outside, you know, that is always guaranteeing that they're the object of love, right?
Yeah. So it seems to me that we're placing those limits on them, on our mind, our perception of the world, that we think that this is the way things are, when actually, if we check, as you're saying, that the way things are is the potential of what they can be. And we in Buddhism, you know, I've had experience with Buddhism for the past 10 years. I've been going to various classes, various schools, and understanding that the Buddha nature, or Buddha seed, if you talk a bit about the Buddha seed or Buddha nature, mm-hmm. and how that plays into this. Yeah.
So as Buddhists, we believe that every single living being has what we call Buddha nature or a Buddha seed. So all that means translated is potential. It's our potential to develop, realize, practice, and transform all our minds into virtuous minds, our full potential, you know. So you know, I think there's a lot about developing your potential and transformational kinds of practices. And what I love about Buddhism is that it's ancient, over 2,500 years. Mm-hmm. And Buddha taught these teachings. You know, there was a real person, Shakyamuni Buddha in India, and he taught these practices then. And they're very profound and deep. And what's great about my teacher, well, all Buddhist practices, but what's really, I think, helpful with the teachings that my teacher has presented to me, is that I don't have to go to India and I don't have to become a yogi and I don't have to, you know, meditate in a cave to realize these teachings. I can do it. I can realize it in my own home. I can do it at work. I can do it on the meditation cushion. I can do it while taking the subway. So my Buddha potential, my Buddha nature, everyone possesses it. And when we train in different meditations, so for example, love is the topic of this show. There are different meditations on love. When we train in love, we increase our capacity for love. We are increasing our enthusiasm to practice a meditation on love. We start becoming more a person who experiences love more, feels love more, gives out more love. And a funny thing happens. More love comes back to us.
Yeah,
and
I think we'll start
to feel it.
Also, the way we talk about our experiences frames or informs our experience of those events, so that sometimes people think to themselves, oh, I can't be a loving person, or I'm not a loving person. And that limits the ability to perceive or to see what's going on in the moment, that we're not mindful, that we're not aware, because we got this story in our mind that that this person, I'll never be loving to this person. But actually, if we check that we experience, if we kind of, that's that narrative or that story that we have in our mind that limits our view. And you know, we have this running thought in our mind, and that meditation for me operates in a way to quiet that story and then be able to see in the moment what's really going on. Would you say?
Great point. Yeah. Stories, beliefs, we have an identity depending on, you know, who you are or where you've been or how old you are. You've developed quite a sophisticated narrative, you know, your family history. And so absolutely. We tell ourselves, I'm not a loving person. I'm just not deserving of love because I don't know how to love or whatever. And the great thing about Buddhist meditation, and particularly the meditations on love, is that it's a training. We train in it, and we can train in it every day. We can sit on our cushion and train in it formally, try to increase our capacity for love. And before we end the show, I'll give you a little meditation on affectionate love and increasing our capacity for affectionate love, and it will increase. It's not, there isn't an inherently, a person who inherently can't feel love.
Yeah.
Everything is changeable. Everything can be transformed, right? We're not fixed. And that feeling, when we identify with this fixed self that has, is not loving, we give it a label, we call it something, and then we believe it.
Mm.
You know, it's not even the perception, it's the belief that that perception of that story is true. And that can cause us incredible amounts of suffering. So, yeah, one way is to change the language and to change the belief. And the way Buddhism works is that you actually, and especially informal meditation, is so invaluable. If you can find a class or if you can listen to teachings on tape or something, it's so valuable to sit on a cushion and actually give yourself the time and space to look at what you believe. What do I believe? You know, and is it true? Is it not true? And if it's not true, you know, let's change it by training in, love.
I just sort of turn to the language you use, the science, and referring to science and the methodology of science, that we affirm our belief in things, or we affirm our trust in things that have been tested. And what you were saying about it being an ancient tradition, that these methodologies, these vocabularies have been tried by various practitioners from ancient times into modern times, into our contemporaries. and that they've tested them and they've produced results. And those results are the basis upon which we are assured that we too can achieve those results. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So the lineage that we receive of teachings coming directly from Buddha pass from teacher to disciple to teacher to disciple to teach, you know, down through over 2,500 years is so powerful. And these teachings are so precious because they, many, many people have achieved enlightenment. In Buddhist time, and now with Geshe Kelsang and Kadampa Buddhism, you know, it's a tradition that's very optimistic about the fact that we can actually achieve this. This isn't some goal that, you know, that's an ancient goal or it's too big for us. It actually is a practice. If we do it incrementally, we can begin to notice in ourselves a change, and then we just increase it. So it's very practical. It's maybe easy, you know, I would say it depends on who the person is, but basically the practice is easy. I think what's difficult is really having faith that we can change. You know, can I do this, or am I going to make time in my, you know, everyone's very busy these days, but yeah. But everyone has 5 minutes in the morning. So, you know, can I do it 5 minutes in the morning? Can I do it 5 minutes when I'm on the train? Can I do it 5 minutes before I go to bed?
Sometimes I've heard the saying that it's life or work is achievement comes from 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. But my dad actually reversed that formula to me. He told me that it actually is 99% inspiration and 1% perspiration, right? And I began to think about that, and I began to realize that really that's true, and that when you flood your system with the faith and the joy that comes from having achieved the desire, the wish to want to achieve the results, that then it doesn't become work. It doesn't feel tiresome or workful. Rather, it becomes joyful. So that's what I think the objective of Buddhism with the joyful path, that we transform these adverse conditions into the path, because we see it as we can become so full of faith, so full of mental absorption with the object, with the objective, that then every moment becomes like I'm just moving towards the objective. Like weightlifters don't think to themselves, like if I were lifting a weight if I were lifting a large weight for something that seems like I don't want to do this, maybe I, you know, would find that very painful. But a weightlifter views that I'm going to become stronger. Their objective is that I'm going to build up muscle. So whatever weight is just pushing themselves, that inspiration, that flooding of desire to be a strong person. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I want to share a funny story that's exactly on that point. So I just returned from visiting my mother, and I've been meditating for 20 years and literally that means two classes a week. I go to, you know, when I'm in the city, I go to the city temple that we have in Manhattan. And my mother said, you know, the other day, she said, you know, are you still going to those classes? You know, haven't you learned how to meditate yet?
Yeah.
And you know, on one level, maybe she's right. On another level, the reason I keep going is exactly what you said. It is so much fun.
Yeah.
And it's very powerful to meditate in a group. And I feel great afterwards. It's kind of like going to the gym of the mind. Like you go to your gym or your pool because you love that feeling, the endorphins, and after you've worked out. So our mind actually is quite active all the time and undisciplined. So we call it mind training. We sometimes call meditations mind training, but it isn't training as in a cult kind of way, but literally like kind of the way we train physically to get into better shape. So we're training our mind because right now our mind is really undisciplined. You know, we might think I don't want to be angry, but something happens like a switch. We're really angry very quickly. So the more you train in peaceful minds, positive minds, minds of love, minds of compassion, universal compassion, the more you have the storage of positivity. So yeah, it's exactly what you said. It's very joyful, very blissful. That's why I go. And and also it helps me then throughout the rest of the week, right?
So let's go a little bit more into, you were saying that different gradations of love, affection, love, wishing, love, and the different step-ups that we can take towards leading towards compassion. And then we could kind of zoom in on defining this vocabulary and this terminology, so that then when people experience love, it's like a cloud. That's a cloud of experience. When they zoom in and they get a very clear, using discrimination, using words, they're able to say, this is, you know, affection love, this is wishing love, and then amplify those aspects.
Okay. Well, I'll start with affectionate love. So, but I wanted to just actually read this very beautiful quote by one of our main gurus from the past, Jetson Kapa. He was a spiritual teacher in Tibet. And he says, through watering the ground of affectionate love with cherishing love, and then sowing the seeds of wishing love and compassion, the medicinal tree of bodhicitta will grow. So right there are five kinds of love that are distinguished: affectionate love, cherishing love, wishing love, compassion, and bodhicitta, which is the ultimate great mind of universal compassion, right? That we spoke about earlier. I'll just go a little bit into, I'll start with training, the training in affectionate love. So in this training, we learn to develop and maintain a warm heart and a feeling of being close to all living beings without exception. This affectionate love makes our mind pure and balanced and prepares the foundation for generating the next level, which is cherishing love for all living beings. So let me just sort of repeat that again. It's maintaining a warm heart and a feeling of being close to all living beings without exception. The first part of the definition sounds pretty easy. Oh, I can maintain a warm heart and a feeling of being close without exception. I think for most people, and certainly for me, when I first heard the definition, was incredible. Like, without exception, really? For all living beings, can I do that? So you can see, this is just the first stage, but how profound it is as a training. And we start in meditation. We literally, like, meditate. You know, first you clear your mind and you do maybe some breathing meditation, and then you start to bring objects of affectionate love. Like, who do I feel warm affectionate love towards? And first, we can always start with people that are close to you. Always start in a meditation with, you know, I mean, I wouldn't start with a stranger, and I wouldn't start with, you know, your enemy, or if you know someone that you are having a problem with. You start at your capacity. So you start with objects that you actually do feel affectionate love, and just consider their qualities, consider their kindness, consider why you have a lot of affection towards them. And that kind of consideration will bring up in your heart, in your mind, right? A feeling of this warm, affectionate love. So that, I'm just giving you just a little bit of a sense of what one definition is and how you would train in it in meditation.
Yeah, I think also to comment on that, you know, we think that with that exception aspect, that sometimes we think, or I think to myself, that I don't like this person, I don't love this person because of what they did, the action they took. But then when we zoom into it, it's like, if someone I really loved a great deal did that same action, I might forgive them because I love them, but someone who I've somehow, for whatever reasons, I've started an aversion for, they perform that same action, suddenly it fits into my narrative that they're the bad guy. And I think that identifying that, you know, how we kind of have this attraction and aversion, and giving language to it, saying, not thinking of it in terms of external circumstances, but as an internal state, is very important. And I think that in this, with that exception aspect, is very important for people to realize that the rationales we come up with why we don't love people who we make that exception for, is, you know, is important to make. Yeah,
no, and absolutely. And we have all kinds, we call them in Buddhism aversions, you know, dislikes, and for many reasons, and we feel they're very extremely valid. So it's really important to understand that whilst others are performing deeds that we don't like or do like, or, you know, we the only thing we can control, we can't control others. We can't control what comes our way when we wake up in the morning. We can't control what's happening on the news when we turn on the news. We can't control, we can hardly control, you know, our family or our pets. And I would say we actually, we can't even control that. But the one thing we can, and Buddhism offers us the training to do, is control our mind.
Yeah.
Right? So you're absolutely right. There's nothing we can do. We can, and with the outside, with the exterior world. Mm. So what we want to do is shore up our reactions, right? Mm. The without exception is incredible, because at some point in our training, if we commit to it, it will be without exception. So let's take an example. Let's take an example of an enemy, someone we dislike who does things that annoy us, that upset us, that are unkind, right? One could maybe, you know, someone could ask, well, what about that person? Surely, you know, why should we feel affectionate love for that person? At some point in our training, we're going to understand, and this isn't a show on karma, so we're not going to, I won't go deeply into it, but we're going to understand that whatever we, all our actions, whatever we put out in the world, so that person that we don't like because they're doing things that appear to our minds as unkind, destructive, whatever, that karma will create a consequence.
Yeah.
And actually, when we really understand the consequence of our actions, and we see others doing things, and we know the consequence of their actions are going to bring that karma back to them, what's going to happen is we're actually going to witness that. And instead of anger and hatred and aversion, we're going to feel so much compassion. I know this sounds incredible and maybe impossible, but it's only that right now because we haven't trained.
Yeah.
But once we start our training, we're going to understand, oh my gosh, that action is going to cause so much suffering in the future for that person. If I did that action, it would cause suffering for me. Mm. You know, actually what's, you'll notice, oh, what's arising right now is compassion.
Yeah.
And that's why training, that's why it's a training. We're not there yet. We have lots of exceptions to affectionate love. Yeah. But if we keep doing it, and if we really commit ourselves to it, and we understand, not only is this beneficial for my own mind, but I'm going to help a lot of other people, because I'm just going to be radiating kindness, love, affectionate love, you know, in to a stranger, to animals, and it's that's beneficial. That's beneficial for our family. It's beneficial for our circle of friends. It's beneficial for our community. You know, we're just walking around in a kind of community where we're emanating this kind of love coming from this good heart, right? The bodhicitta actually just also means good heart. We're a person with a good heart, and we train in developing love, right? Increasing the capacity of that good heart.
And also, I'll just continue a little bit on connecting back the karma to the love, is that sometimes we see people who may be in a, there's instances where we see people who are, we think getting their dog's day, you know, the dog, every dog has a day, and we think, oh, they got it, you know. But actually, if we check, we had the potential to be in that same situation. And we think that we have, you know, a lot of times there's a presumption that I would never do something like that, or I would never commit that action. But, you know, there's many actions in the past that we've done. Like, just to give a concrete example, like I pulled out my phone, and then like something, I got a charge for a subscription for something that was ongoing, right? And I'm like, oh, why did that happen? But actually, it's because, you know, I didn't, I committed the action of saying, oh, recharge me at the beginning when I subscribed for the service, right? I said, oh, monthly recharge, said, okay. And then later I decided to myself that I didn't want to continue the service. And then suddenly I realized I got a charge for it. So instead of getting angry, I was like, well, I did that. Now I have to, you know, view that as a way to, you know, they call it purifying in Buddhism, that we're purifying all those negative views, all those negative actions, and that then I'm making myself available to correct that in the future, like, by unsubscribing. And this is a very mundane example, but I think that it illustrates the point that that when someone else does that same action, it's a very neutral this example is very neutral. It doesn't cause a lot of charge. Yeah. But like when someone else says that, you're kind of like, oh, I've been there. I've done that. Yeah. And you empathize. And that empathy is the important thing. Yeah.
No, it's a great example. It's absolutely a great example because many difficult things come our way all the time. Right. Mm. And it's a choice. Do we see it as, oh, maybe I was part of that problem, or, you know, I created some action in the past that led to this consequence developing. Mm. You know, also we have choices on how to view things. So we can think about what we don't have every day, right? Or we can be wake up and feel grateful that we have, you know, maybe someone's listening to this program and thinking, okay, and they're really upset and they're thinking, okay, but now I have a bit of information on how to train in a practice that's going to benefit me. Mm-hmm. So it's choices, right? We wake up and really we have so much choice and we have so many options on how to view others, to view ourselves, to view our potential, to transform ourselves. And it, I don't think it takes, you know, huge amounts of effort or time. I think we can do it. These meditations are so delightful. We can do it in our daily lives. We can, I think it's always good to have some training on a cushion. So when I say cushion, I just mean like formally sitting in a meditation posture because then we kind of are really thinking through, you know, what am I going to meditate on? What's my intention? This is how I'm going to do it. This is the mind that will arise. When that mind, that warm, affectionate, loving mind arises, at that moment, we've got our object of meditation and we enjoy it. We just hang out there for as long as we want. And then it will go because, you know, we maybe we don't have a lot of power in our meditation to hold a mind of love. And then we start again. We go back to the beginning of the meditation, bring to mind people that we feel affectionate love. You know, those a mind of love arises, hold the object. Eventually, the next time we sit down or the next month that we sit down to do the same meditation, we can say, okay, I'm going to bring some of those exceptions and we can start to bring in strangers, you know, people that we don't even know. Can I feel affectionate love for someone I don't know? Absolutely. Then we've been training, you know, I don't know, a couple of years, a couple of months, and we think, okay, I'm ready. I'm ready for the big one. I'm ready for the enemy.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring the enemy into my meditation and just check and see, can I do it? And maybe that day we find, oh, wow, my capacity for love is so enormous. It's so bountiful. It's free. It doesn't cost me anything. Today I can love my enemy, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, ultimately it benefits us. I mean, the negative minds ultimately hurt us. They cause us suffering, right? And that suffering is profound and deep. So, you know, that's why I think these are not only scientific methods that Buddha taught, but they're so practical. And they're practical regardless of what you do in your life, regardless of where you are, regardless of where you live. Everyone can benefit, you know? And again, I think then when we embody that, you know, so the Kadampa meditation tradition is a part of a tradition that's called the Mahayana path, where we're doing all these practices ultimately to benefit others. So we train so that ultimately we can help others also experience happiness and be free from suffering. That's our motivation. I see so much suffering around me.
Yeah.
You know, how do I get rid of it? Well, I'm going to work on my capacity for love. I'm going to increase my love because these are, you know, I mentioned the five different paths. So the last two, you know, the last couple, bodhicitta, universal love, are a mind that's so powerful, so loving, so vast that we don't have to think about it at that point. If we really are able to hold a mind of bodhicitta, this mind of great universal love, we are emanating it all the time. We are just everybody that's coming in our path. You know, I remember, I'm going to share the story that the first time I heard the word bodhicitta, like I thought, okay, you know, compassion was a huge mind of love. I didn't really know there was a bigger mind. Mm. And I remember the first time that my teacher told me these two words, bodhicitta, and that this was like the greatest mind of love. I was so moved because I actually, up until the point I, you know, 20 years ago that I hadn't practiced and I hadn't trained in meditation, I just thought, well, everyone's given a certain amount and yeah. we use that quota, right?
Yeah.
And some people have a little more and some people have a little less. And I didn't know that everyone, regardless of where they're coming from or starting, has this potential to have this incredible capacity. And I really personally believe it is the key to everything. It's the answer to everything. You know, one of the like I would just say, you know, privately, like one of the benefits of practicing love is kindness.
Yeah.
You just start to become a really kind person because you understand, you know, you understand why people are suffering.
And I just want to say a lot of people perceive, and maybe I perceived in the beginning when I started to be introduced to these teachings, that, you know, the kindness is somehow passive or being a pushover, that if I'm too kind, I'm being a pushover, I'm accepting everything and doing, you know, just that's a perception a lot of people have. But then I just want to say that, you know, when your child or when a child does something that's quote unquote wrong or bad, the reaction of most parents is to not, you know, to understand that they're on that path of learning, that they're on that path of kind of adopting tech, you know, the adult skills and such. So we are very understanding with some people, and we're not like reactionary, and that it's not that analytic aspect or that aspect of understanding or seeing how this can be applied in various situations, that, you know, it's not a it's just a view that we can be assertive, we can be powerful, and we can react to situations in the appropriate way without coming from a place of anger. We can come from a place of love and react and respond mm-hmm. in the appropriate way. That it's not that we're allowing things bad to happen by being kind, that we're like, oh, this thing is not bad. We're perceiving that they're doing a bad thing. I'm like, some people think, oh, being kind means I can't, you know, take the appropriate action in the situation to stop the negative. But actually, that's what you're saying. The bodhicitta means that the state of being love means that we're motivated to produce positive results for other people mm-hmm. and that we're protecting them. And one thing that happened to me was that someone at work said the phrase that you're like the team's bodyguard, you're like our protector. And you know, sometimes people can think that she actually used the term bodyguard, but I translated that to protector. And for me, that was a very powerful moment. And sometimes people can be like forgetting these small compliments or small things that someone said, but I actually really focused on that. And I tried to view myself as the protector of the people I work with. And that in meditation, sometimes that can be amplified by going through the process of sitting with that feeling that you had, that small spark that I had with that comment and that I perceived in that comment, the intention in that comment, and then sitting with it. And sometimes it can be a little pedantic, but you have to sit down and, like, you know, keep your back straight. You know, all these kind of things that we learn in meditative techniques help amplify. Just like if you were starting a fire and you're like, oh, I don't want to go through the process of doing things that would increase that fire, well, then the fire is not going to increase. So I think that there's ways in which fire increases, you know, by fanning it or whatever. I'm not too versed in that technique, but you know what I'm saying. Like, the point is, you know, this is how you do that.
Well,
yeah.
I think the one thing you said that's absolutely correct is that it's kindness and compassion are active. They're
yeah.
absolutely active. They're not passive. They're so powerful. And I loved that your cohorts and coworkers view you as a protector. So a being that has the mind of bodhicitta, once you develop the mind of bodhicitta, or you're on the path of developing the mind of bodhicitta, you become a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is a being bound for enlightenment. And in Buddhist iconography and symbolism, if you look at the different Buddhas and bodhisattvas, some of them You have Manjushri with his wisdom sword. They look quite wrathful. They're in action. You have Buddha Tara, Green Tara, with her right foot extended, ready to leap into action to help all sentient beings, right? These are active minds of compassion. Green Tara is the Buddha of compassion. Manjushri is the Buddha of wisdom. These Buddhas, these symbols are, we can view them as our potential, right? Our active potential to increase and improve our minds of love, of wisdom, of action, of kindness, right? And we, and it's so powerful, actually, when we think of ourselves as protectors, as bodhisattvas. Like, that's my path. I mean, I have a job and I get up in the morning and I'm a father or a mother or a cousin or a daughter, but I'm really internally a bodhisattva. That's my real identification. You know, and bodhisattva, that they're beings that they'll spend their whole lives, you know, on the path to developing these minds that will get us enlightened. Yeah. So we want to be those active protectors. We like that. I know that there's a huge trend now with superheroes and super heroines, which is fabulous. And I think, you know, bodhisattvas are great superheroes and super heroines that we can identify with. You know, that's our cape. You know, love is our cape that we put on our bodhisattva outfit, you know, internally. And we are armed to go into the world to help sentient beings and disarm them with our compassion, with our kindness, with our love, right?
So I think one thing that'll help, I think, people listening, and it helped me, was that understanding that the view we have currently is like an illusion, that there's a metaphor that's used in Buddhism that might illuminate how to break through any barrier that comes up with a limited view, that we think of as limited view, that we're limited, that our capacity is limited. Sometimes we see something that looks like a snake, we see a snake, right? And we're like, oh, fear is invoked, right? You telling someone, oh, think it through, it's not a snake, may not have that magic as much as seeing that it's a rope, you know, that's actually a rope. And then seeing that it's a rope, the fear disappears in a second, you know? So once you have that ability to, I mean, there's some of it is analytic, being able to understand, you know, that talking yourself through it. But then I think the moment of seeing is something that'll break that spell. And it's not, and then you're able to act in a way and are coming from a place that is more appropriate to that situation. You're not confined by the fear or by the anxiety. So,
So, I mean, this is a huge topic. These are the wisdom teachings of how we are constantly misperceiving reality, right? Mm. So you just said it, you know, like we have something arises, we see something, we misperceive it. We see a rope, we think snake, fear arises. We realize it's a rope, fear disappears. Mm. So in that same way, every moment we're misperceiving reality, right? And the greatest misperception is actually how we exist. So we think the self that we perceive, we wake up, there's a self, you know, and we have given it an identity. And we, you know, that morning it's a depressed self and we think it's real, it's fixed, it's unchangeable, right? You know, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I'm just saying, so that perception is a misperception. It's not the way in which we exist, actually. You know, the self that we perceive and that we believe that perception of does us harm, right? We see that it's fixed. We see it as existing inherently, right? So in Buddhism, through the wisdom teachings, and particularly the teachings on emptiness and the way in which things really exist, which I won't even begin to go into now, but we begin to see, oh, these are misperceptions, right? And the reason I can even come on your radio show and do a talk on increasing love is because we're not fixed, is because ourself has this incredible potential, and is because we can change and transform. And that can only happen because we're not fixed. We're not inherently existing. We are actually moment by moment creating a pure world with our positive pure minds, right? So moment by moment, the more we train in positive pure minds, the more the world that appears to us will appear positive, pure, full of potential, right?
Yeah.
And even if it doesn't appear as such, we have that power in our mind to help others view a situation or to transform their situations, right?
Yeah.
So it's a really important point. And
Wow, what a powerful conversation happening here on Radio Free Brooklyn. So as we continue the conversation, I just want to say, like, yeah, I mean, that's very powerful, transformative, if we choose to view it in that way. And that choice is very important, that we can be convinced, we can allow ourselves to be convinced of any point if, you know, we just look at the evidence and then we're like convincing ourselves that our choice is involved in that. And being active, I think, is very important, that I choose to be limitless. I choose to be full of love. I choose to be full of compassion. I choose to move towards a place of bodhicitta. And that decision, that it's not anybody else's responsibility, it's my responsibility to have that experience for myself. So I invite everyone to make that choice for themselves, that they would do that, you know? So I would have the question about, again, what are the building up the analytic techniques, and then we can kind of, we're starting to wrap up. But
okay. Yeah. So, building up the analytic techniques, I'm assuming you're just talking about the meditations.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So, it's a progression, but also we can start to, it doesn't have to go in order, for example. So we went over a little bit affectionate love, but cherishing love, for example, one of the meditation that we can do that I wanted to just raise is, which is very powerful for me personally, is to think about the kindness of others, the kindness of all living beings. So, this morning I woke up, I took my dog into the park, and then I came back, and just someone built that park, someone paved the streets, someone, you know, built the coffee store that I go to get my morning coffee, or someone, every single thing in my life is due to the kindness of others, actually.
Yeah.
Not most of the things that I use, public transportation, the city that I live in, you know, the places that I go to, are due to the kindness of others. Now, one could say, well, you know, you pay your taxes or you pay for services. Yes, but people are still kind. There are many places in the world where you can't buy these services because they don't exist, or there's, they're corrupt, or people's taxes don't get them services. So every day we can wake up and we can think about the kind, we have clean air, you know, we have, I can turn on a faucet and get water that I can drink right out of the faucet. You know, I had nothing to do with that plumbing. I had nothing to do with the, just every system that I use.
Yeah.
And that kindness, really meditating on the kindness of others. So that's a very specific meditation that we can train on to develop all the different aspects of love, is extremely powerful. And when we're, you know, for example, we can do that on the cushion, but we can do it as we go to work, just thinking everything that's happening to me is kind of appearing like out of a dream to help me get to my job, or to help me, you know, I didn't have time to make breakfast. I can stop at a bodega and get a bagel and cream cheese. If, for example, there's a lot of construction going on the weekends with subways, but there are all these useful signs or car services or other ways we can get to where we need to go. So all of that kindness is appearing for me. And when you really meditate on the kindness of others, on how kind living beings are, what rises in your heart? Affection, cherishing love. Oh, so that's another very concrete meditation
that we
could do.
And also the experience I had, I went on Bushwick Junction a couple of weeks ago, and I did an interview where I was a guest on the interview with Asha, the host Asha. And I had to kind of recount the junctions in my life, kind of telling my life story, basically. And my experience was that it felt like I was recounting a dream that I was trying to remember, because I was, you know, obviously I can't tell every little nitty gritty detail about every single day and every single decision I made. But the effect of that interview and the effect of telling your life story all the time is that you're like, you're changing it. It's very permeable, as you're saying. It's very changeable. And that you're changing it, you're emphasizing certain things, you're reducing the emphasis in other things. And that choice creates a painting in people's minds and your own mind that, you know, we think, oh, but, you know, these things happened or that thing happened. But actually, the way you view it is the thing that illustrates it, and the way that you act in accordance with. So, you know, the idea, the kind of cliche thought of being in the now and being that only the now exists is such a trafficked area. But being able to understand that all the narratives we have about the past is just that, it's a narrative, and that we kind of can perceive the moment as the past existing in this moment. Mm-hmm. Right now, we have the whole future and past in our mind in an instant, you know? Mm-hmm. And being able to see that and being able to see how we can break free of the limits that we've placed on those narratives. So, yeah.
Someone, a Buddhist once said to me, if you want to know what happened in your past, look at your present moment. Yeah. And if you want to know what's going to happen in your future, look at your present moment. So yeah. Those are, you know, from the teachings on karma. So we always want to know the story, right?
Yeah. Like
what's going to happen and what, you know, what will happen in the future. But really it's a moment to moment arising. And as you said before, we're changing it, depending on the minds that are arise. So if positive minds are arising, you use the word purification, which is often used in Buddhism. And it's actually a really wonderful word because it means that I reacted to this thing in the past, this negative thing, and with negativity, and it's coming up again. But if I change my reaction, I purify it. It's gone. Like, I can even laugh. Oh, look, this thing that always happens to me makes me annoyed. You know, I'm going to laugh at it today. I am not, you know. So my husband, for example, this is just a funny story, loves to watch. He's Scottish, and he loves to watch soccer, football, I guess they call it. on Sunday. And so the other day, but we live in a very small Brooklyn apartment, and you know, my desk and writing desk is work area is in the living room where the television is. And so I said, you know, how long is the soccer season? Because he watches all the, I think he was watching Manchester and Liverpool today. You know, and he looked at me with a straight face and he said, November. And I said, it's January.
Yeah.
And then I thought, wait, stop. You know, this is his one enjoyment.
Yeah.
He's a carpenter who works really hard. This is his one enjoyment. And I can find a coffee place to go and work on Sunday mornings, you know. I was laughing because it's every Sunday, it's the same reaction. I'm like, oh, the great, the TV, you know, I don't particularly care for it, but I'm having the same reaction. Whereas if I just change my reaction, it's not going to be a problem anymore.
Yeah, it's
right?
Like kind of like when you sometimes the experience I have is that when you read about something like, let's say, for example, you're reading about a cat and you're all the descriptive words of a cat and all these instructions about what a cat is, but then seeing the cat and putting that label of the cat makes that connection, and you're able to experience that this is what a cat is in reality, and hearing the meow of the cat. So like in that instance, I think that, you know, being able to say, oh, these are the trainings of patience, and being able to remind yourself of the patience and acceptance and love. And putting those labels on it helps, because then it makes that direct connection between your experience and the teachings of the writings in the book, you know?
Well, you started the show and you wanted very specific definitions. And I think the inherent or the underlying question is, why does Buddhism have so many definitions
for
something that's, you know, like you could say, well, I know what love is. You know, there are many songs on love. We heard one coming in. We're going to hear one coming out of the show. Why is Buddhism so specific? I think the reason is because it's very beneficial for us to know exactly what we're doing with our mind, right?
Mm.
So when we are when we know the definition and when we know what we need to do with our mind and we know how to train, we know when we've accomplished it, right? If it's really large and amorphous and general, we don't know whether we're in the vicinity. We don't know what to do once we get there. The reason I like Buddhist meditation so much is that there are stages of it. It's not just about feeling something. It's about setting an intention, understanding what the analytic meditation, the process of getting to that state of mind, when the state of mind arises, holding it, holding that state of mind, and then at the very end, dedicating. So the specific definitions work with the specific stages of the meditation process.
Yeah.
And then we can walk away and say, okay, it wasn't a great meditation, but I did it, right? We're training. It's like when you're running a marathon, you don't run 24 miles in the first, or is that a marathon? I think it's around 20 something miles.
Yeah.
Right? I don't run marathons.
Okay, yeah.
But you start running a couple of miles, you train, and you increase your weekly mileage. Meditation is the same thing, same process.
Great. So I hope that people feel very inspired by this conversation to continue to train and work on that. And I just want to give a thank you to Sasha Sugar and give a shout out to my regular show is Truth to Power Show, which is on Thursdays at 9 a.m. It airs on Radio Free Brooklyn, and that's the show I normally host. And hope you guys will tune into that. And the conversations I had in that show have been very transformative and very very helpful. And I hope that you guys will view that as well. So we'll end with the Beatles, Within You and Without You.
Life goes on within you and without you.